Right. I'm going to go with it and hope I'm not too echoey for everyone. Anyway, good morning. Talk this morning, I'm going to be speaking about Peter. And I've sort of entitled the talk, Peter Teaching Us How to Live Our Lives. So over the past couple of months, I've found myself drawn to both 1 and 2 Peter. And if I'm being honest, historically, they're books of the Bible that I've often skimmed over because I've found them quite challenging, and I didn't really like them very much compared to some of the other New Testament books. By contrast, do you want to? Okay, yeah. Maybe that will help. By contrast, against some of Paul's writings, I found that often Paul focused more on the grace we've received. And whenever I read Peter in the past, I found... Do you want me to just switch to that mic? Would that be easier? Because I'm going really, really echoey. Okay, I'll carry on, that's fine. I think I'll just try and re-summarise because I was finding that echoing so confusing. As I was saying, Peter, a book I've often ignored, an area of the Bible I've often, well, not ignored, but skimmed over relative to Paul. Paul focuses quite heavily on grace we've received in a lot of his teachings. I haven't, when I've read it, found that theme as much in common in 1 and 2 Peter. And when I've read it, I've often felt like it focuses really heavily on how we act, which I've found quite challenging and difficult to understand and to not just feel a bit guilty whenever I read it. And I have previously heard or read discussions on the importance of the balance between Peter's and Paul's teachings. And indeed, one thing I was thinking about is if we focus too much on individual teachings, then we actually fall into a trap that Paul warned against in his letter to the Corinthians. So I'm going to start there. So in 1 Corinthians... Okay. So this is 1 Corinthians 1, verses 11 to 17. My brothers and sisters, some from Chloe's household have informed me that there are quarrels among you. What I mean is this. One of you says, I follow Paul. Another, I follow Apollos. Another, I follow Cephas. And still another, I follow Christ. Is Christ divided? Was Paul crucified for you? Were you baptized in the name of Paul? I thank God that I did not baptize any of you except Crispus and Gaius, so no one can say that you were baptized in my name. Yes, I also baptized the household of Stephanas. Beyond that, I don't remember if I baptized anyone else. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not with wisdom and eloquence, lest the cross of Christ be emptied of its power. Now, I often historically have read this passage and just thought to myself how silly the Corinthians are to have got into this mindset. But I was thinking about it some more, and one thing I thought I have to remind myself of is that those believers probably had limited access to biblical scripture, biblical teaching at the time. They certainly probably didn't just have a whole Bible to pick up and read and get the big picture. So they probably latched onto particular pieces of text or particular teachings that they'd received and that they could recall. And so then what started happening was they argued about which one was correct, because it was all they really had for reference. But then I thought, well, actually, I recognize that sometimes I can be no better. We can shy away from certain Bible verses because we don't like them very much. We can hone in on others because they're more aligned with what we like and what we think about. But in that way, we're, just like the Corinthians, favouring a particular teaching, and ultimately we're not looking at the teaching of the Bible and therefore God. So this time, when, as I say, I came back to reading 1 Peter and 2 Peter, I made a concerted effort to not shy away from it. And instead, I wanted to really focus on reading it and see what there was to learn from it. I'm still trying to not focus too much on one writer. So on the flip side, I'm trying to not focus too much on Peter. But I hope that I can see what he has to say, how it is important, and how it keeps in with the larger picture of the Bible. So I'm going to now focus the majority of my talk on 1 Peter chapter 2. Now, some of you might know, my dad is a trained Baptist minister. So sometimes when I'm preparing for talks, I'll drop him a message and say, I'm thinking about speaking around this particular passage. Have you got any sort of supporting materials that I might be able to read just to help me get the bigger picture? So I said, I'm thinking of speaking on 1 and 2 Peter. And he said, which bit? It's quite a lot of notes I've got on it. So I said, okay, 1 Peter chapter 2, and I gave him a couple of ones as well. So he said, yep, 1 Peter chapter 2. Just be careful, one of the PDFs is 75 pages. And it was 1 Peter chapter 2. So I hope you've all come prepared for a very, very long talk. Thankfully, I did choose to not go for 75 pages. It's a little shorter. But it was helpful. And that's a little bit guiding how we're going to think about this chapter today. So I am going to start by reading all of 1 Peter chapter 2, because it's what I want to focus the talk around. I think it's important you've got the whole picture of what's said there. So starting in verse 1. Therefore, rid yourselves of all malice and all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, slander of every kind. Like newborn babies, crave pure spiritual milk, so that by it you may grow up in your salvation, now that you have tasted that the Lord is good. As you come to him, the living stone, rejected by humans, but chosen by God and precious to him, you also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. For in Scripture it says, "See, I lay a stone in Zion, a chosen and precious cornerstone, and the one who trusts in him will never be put to shame. Now to you who believe, this stone is precious, but to those who do not believe, the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone, and a stone that causes people to stumble and a rock that makes them fall. They stumble because they disobey the message, which is also what they were destined for. But you are a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. Once you were not a people, but now you are the people of God. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. Dear friends, I urge you, as foreigners and exiles, to abstain from sinful desires which wage war against your soul. Live such good lives among the pagans that, though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. Submit yourselves, for the Lord's sake, to every human authority, whether to the emperor as the supreme authority, or to governors who are sent by him to punish those who do wrong and to commend those who do right. For it is God's will that by doing good you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. Live as free people, but do not use your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Live as God's slaves. Show proper respect to everyone. Love the family of believers. Fear God, honor the emperor. Slaves, in reverent fear of God, submit yourselves to your masters, not only to those who are good and considerate, but also to those who are harsh. For it is commendable if someone bears up under the pain of unjust suffering because they are conscious of God. But how is it to your credit if you receive a beating for doing wrong and endure it? But if you suffer for doing good and you endure it, this is commendable before God. To this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps." He committed no sin, and no deceit was found in his mouth. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the cross, so that we might die to sins and live for righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed, for you were like sheep going astray, but now you have returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. Now, there's a lot going on in this passage, and indeed the study notes I mentioned, they observed that it's actually quite difficult for the reader to find a logical sequence to what Peter's writing about here. He seems to cover a lot of ground and jumps around ideas quite significantly. There is a clear theme about holy living running through it, though. So if I jump back to verse 1 for a moment, and I'll just have it there so you can see. Verse 1 opens with Peter urging the believers to rid themselves of deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and slander. This is a clear instruction in how to speak. Moreover, in verse 11, he urges us to abstain from sinful desires. So there are very clear instructions in how to live. They are a challenge to us. So we're often reminded that if we do falter, Jesus forgives us. And yet these verses instruct us to abstain from sin, which got me thinking, why such strong wording? And before I attempt to answer that question, I'm going to actually hand it over to you all to have a quick chat about. So talk to the person next to or near you. Simple question, possibly quite a difficult answer. Why does Peter make such strong statements about abstaining from sin in these verses? I'll give you a couple of minutes to chat about that and then get some feedback. There's lots of good chat. I'll give you another minute. Okay, it seems like conversations are possibly wrapping up. Now, I can do teach a thing and pick on people, but would anyone like to volunteer something their group spoke about, why they thought maybe Peter was making these very strong statements about abstaining from sin? And I want to kick us off. Oh, two groups. Who wants to go first? Why not is a good question. Yeah, and we can look at that in more detail. Anyone have anything... more than why not? Or was that the general feeling? Yeah, Peter, having lived with Jesus and seen that example. Yeah, he was trying to then go, well, we need to try and live up to that example. That's a good thought. Anyone have any? Sorry, I don't know how much more to say. It was the idea that Peter had been a disciple of Jesus, had seen the standard, and knew that they had to live at a greater standard than the Pharisees based on their time with Jesus. That was the sort of thought there. Sorry, yes. No, that's fine. Thank you for checking. Any groups go on a different thought or have any other ideas? Yeah. Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's a theme that runs throughout the Bible. Yeah, avoiding sin. Any other thoughts?
John was saying about the fact that he was probably speaking to a young church that needed like strong guidance.
Yeah, so they were a young church and they would have probably come from a background of not being aware of the standards they should live to, and that may well have played a part in it as well. Yeah. Yeah, the consistency and integrity, I think, is really important. And I think that's where I'm going to jump back into what I was thinking about. Because, yeah, there's lots of good points there. I think it's particularly the consistency and integrity that Peter picks up on. As we look around the specific verses about abstaining from sin, we see that there is a clear purpose that he gives to the church for abstaining from sin. So whilst it is true that if we falter, we will receive forgiveness, the point Peter makes here is if our lives do not differ from the pagans, as he puts it, then we will find it harder to actually glorify God and bring other people to knowing him. Also, this is an occasion where, having had some notes to know about the original Greek, was quite helpful, because it makes it a little more clear what he was meaning as well. So in the words, I'm trying to find the verse where it falls out. So in verse 12, where it says, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us. That word see, from the original meaning, referred to a careful watching over a period of time. So not just looking at you and seeing that you're good, but sort of this idea of scrutinizing your life and watching it over a long time period. And so what Peter's encouraging them is that if the pagans watched you for a long period of time, they would not be able to find an accusation of doing wrong. So immediately, that's a bit of a challenge, you know, if you're saying that, okay, so over a sustained period of time in scrutiny, do I live a good life? The purpose of this is that we will glorify God. So if the pagans see that our lives are so transformed, they can't accuse us of doing wrong, and they only see the good that we do, then that life will point them to Jesus. And there is another interesting related thought here. This attitude could also relate to the reputation of the church. So in first century Asia Minor, where this church would have been based, having a bad reputation was as big a problem as it is today. And indeed, it sort of suggests here that despite potentially Christians living a good life, they are still accused of doing wrong. And this text, I think, speaks with relevance to us today. I think it would be fair to say that for a number of people who don't yet believe in Christ, they see the church with a bad reputation. There are certainly some views that the Church of England has too much power over the state. There's lots of bad press on opinions presented around issues of gender, sexuality, even less sensitive issues like evolution. And there is a sad history of abuse within some churches, which has come to light quite a lot recently. And there are also those who judge the church historically for all sorts of things that the church has been perceived to be involved in. And so the challenge from Peter here is that people outside the church should only see our good deeds. It may not immediately lead to their conversion. The wording which he uses is that they will glorify God on the day he visits us. So this also suggests there may be a delayed gain for our good deeds. We may still be accused of doing wrong. However, it needs to be that we are sure that we've acted in the way that God has instructed us. And then there is hope presented in this passage that maybe if that's what we are seen for, there could be a reputational shift in the view of the church. I do believe that actually there is already that happening in this country. There's lots of excellent ways the church has been recognized for stepping in, for example, to support food banks. I know that locally we bless others through things like the Christmas food collection. We have our work with the deli school. And I think that really it's sort of areas like this that Peter is encouraging us to press into. Those good acts are the things that then us and the church are seen to be doing. And just to sort of reinforce what I've been speaking about, obviously this passage came from Peter, and we said, you know, these views are views that are common throughout the Bible. Indeed, Jesus spoke about them. So I quite recently was reading Luke 6, and I looked specifically at verses 43 to 45, and we read the following. No good tree bears bad fruit, nor does a bad tree bear good fruit. Each tree is recognized by its own fruit. People do not pick figs from thorn bushes or grapes from briars. A good man brings good things out of the good stored up in his heart, and an evil man brings evil things out of the evil stored up in his heart. For the mouth speaks what the heart is full of. So we see here a reinforcement of what I've just been talking about. If we don't abstain from sinful desires, then we have an evil heart. If we have an evil heart, then we cannot produce good fruit. If we cannot produce good fruit, the world cannot see our good deeds, and God loses the glory. However, if we live lives in the eyes of God, that have been seen to be good, and of the pagans that have been seen to be good, then we have a good heart. Out of a good heart comes good fruit. From that good fruit can come good deeds, and so God is glorified. Now, there's another portion of this passage from Peter that really intrigued me, and that's verses 13 onwards. In all of this part, Peter starts talking about submitting to rulers and authorities, and earthly rulers and authorities at that. I've often found that passage quite interesting and not sure where it comes from. Struggle to understand it when it feels like the church often might feel persecuted by the state, certainly more in other countries as well. So firstly, it's interesting, before we go too deep into this, to consider the historical context of these comments. So he says that you should submit to the emperor. Based on the time of writing, this was very likely Emperor Nero, who was arguably the worst emperor to live under as a Christian or a Jew during the time of the Romans. So despite this persecution that the church felt it was facing, Peter calls them to submit to the emperor. It's clear from the way he writes that he feels that to some extent authority from God is given to these people and that we should respect them. I will go on to talk a little bit more about this, but again, I think this is an interesting point to hear your thoughts, because you may well have some ideas that I didn't come up with. So again, chat to the person near to you. Why do you think Peter calls for us to submit to authorities? And what do you think this looks like? So what does it actually mean to submit to worldly authorities? I'll give you a couple of minutes to chat about that. So why and what does it look like? Okay, well, we've had a couple of minutes to chat, and listening around, I've definitely heard some ideas chatted about that I was thinking. So I said, why do you think Peter calls for us to submit to authority? And maybe what does this look like as well? Again, do any groups want to kick us off with any thoughts on this? Yeah, go on. So there is something clearly in trying to keep the law, but then there is this conflict of, well, what if the law doesn't marry up with what we believe is the correct law? So yeah, that's something which I'll try and explore. But did anyone else have any more thoughts about why perhaps we might need to submit to authority or what this might look like? Yeah, So something that's really important that Marion picked up there is that God is still clearly in the passage the ultimate authority. And so she's saying, well, in the same way that we follow God, the ultimate authority, we should show the same respect to the local authority, potentially, unless there's this conflict again. Any other thoughts? Yeah, so Rolf gave the example of Paul there, who got imprisoned, so clearly hadn't followed every law, but was still respecting the authority by allowing himself to be imprisoned, and then is hoping that God will use that in some way positively. Yeah, good. Any other thoughts? Yeah, what we've just heard that's really good point there is this idea that it is possible to respect somebody and disagree with them, and you don't have to resort to bad language or some other sort of negative response, and you can have a disagreement but still respect the authority. And that sounds really important. And yeah, that is possibly something that we see a lot of people struggle with, respecting authority if they disagree with them. Can be something a lot of people find challenging. Are there any other thoughts? So attempting to summarise what we've just heard there, it's the idea that the authorities are still ordained by God, they're ministers of God, they have a role to reward those who do good and to punish those who do bad. And if we do feel that there has been a line crossed, then we have to ask God for wisdom to verify that. And often it's where potentially that position of authority is in some way being used negatively and vindictively, was the word, against a particular group or belief or something like that. And yeah, there are various thoughts and ideas as to why Peter calls for submission. And to be honest, many of the ones I'm going to talk about have been brought out here, which is really, really good. One thing that I just found interesting when I was reading up on this is it's actually a little unclear to scholars exactly why this sort of passage crops up every now and then in the Bible. The general consensus as to why people like Peter wrote about this is that at the time, how different classes should live was a common concern in Jewish, Roman, and Greek worlds. It was something that they worried about. And so what Peter's providing here is instructions as to how people should live in relation to authorities, and that's then further iterated, for example, with how slaves at the time should live in relation to their masters. And when we think about the idea of submitting, it's important to consider what that submission means within this context. So given the previous part of the passage that we've already looked at, submission in many ways means abstaining from fleshly desires and living a life of good behavior that influences those who are observing. So in many ways, this passage is actually just an application of what's already been spoken about in terms of living good lives. And looking a little more deeply, I believe what Peter's calling for here is order. So it's clear given that this immediately follows verses 11 to 12, that whilst Peter sees it's essential that we submit to government, it's secondary to submitting to God. So we are to live orderly lives as God has ordained, and so we submit to the authorities too. Equally, historically, it's clear that there's not a need to live in total submission. Both the Israelites and the early church did at times participate in civil disobedience when it was necessary. So overall, I get the impression here that submission to authorities is submission most of the time. Submit unless there is a specific reason or need not to. And the issue with not submitting is that sort of suggests the alternative is chaos. Peter is speaking to a group who probably felt they were a minority who were marginalized. He's making sure that they avoid the temptation of chaotic rebellion. He's calling for good conduct that honors God, which calls back to verse 12. This harks back to the Sermon on the Mount, in fact, when in Matthew 5, verse 9, Jesus said, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called children of God." As I mentioned previously, this call for submission is likely during the time of Emperor Nero's rule, so this call for submission applies even in extreme circumstances. As Peter puts it in verses 16 and 17, "By showing proper respect for everyone, we will be servants of God, living free from evil." Now, I just wanted to think of a specific challenging application of this where, if I'm being honest, I don't know what the answer is. It's something I don't think I'm going to know the answer from straight away out of today. But it was an example that came up recently where I thought, oh, it sort of relates to this and it's something for us all to think about. And I've got some sort of ideas of how that applies to our lives coming out of it. So there are stories every now and then that crop up in the press of, well, not just Christians, but Christians are a group in this country who might lose their job for speaking up about a certain aspect of their faith. A recent example which prompted this thought was I came across a story of a secondary school teacher, and she shared her views on her personal social media. And her views were seen as quite aggressively against the teaching of trans ideas to primary children. As a result of this, she lost her job, and she's now spent years in court, garnering media attention, challenging her dismissal. And what I am thinking about is, does this align with what Peter is saying or not? So for me personally, as a teacher, I know it's been made very clear in my job contract that personal life is subject to professional scrutiny, and it's stipulated I can't share political or religious views. So therefore, I'm left wondering, is it right she publicly questioned education policy and was making a big thing of being dismissed? Or is it actually not the right way to go about things? Whilst neither myself nor Peter are calling for us to be silent, I do wonder if perhaps her way of dealing with things was perhaps stretching the idea of submitting to authority and trying to lead a good life. As I say, I don't know where I sit on that, but certainly I thought it was some food for thought in terms of the way we behave. I do think it challenges us to consider our actions, whether they will be for the benefit of others, and whether, therefore, it will end up glorifying God or not. Ultimately, we come full circle with the idea presented in verse 15 that by doing good, you should silence the ignorant talk of foolish people. And what does Peter mean by doing good here? It's likely that he meant doing good to society by benefiting society. So historically, examples of this probably included actions like diverting grain ships to the city to improve supply to markets, erecting or restoring public buildings, widening roads, helping in the city during times of civil upheaval. And I do believe we see clear parallels today with churches nationally and locally stepping in to provide for the needs of others where the state hasn't. I return to thinking about the many good things that we as a local church do. Christmas food hampers, Open Blue, offerings for the deli school, to name a few that I know we do. I know there are lots of other things that individually we do to benefit our local communities. And whilst it would be naive to think that doing these good things would stop all persecution, flip the church's reputation overnight, bring society round to our way of thinking, it's not naive to think that doing these good things would have no effect on those who see them. And ultimately, I think that's what we're called to do. In living our good lives, we will have an impact that hopefully, as a result, preaches the gospel locally and to all nations. Furthermore, as something that we was touched upon before, Peter does highlight that we are free people. And so it's in submitting to God that we submit to the authorities. And so the point of this is that we don't use our freedom in God to live in chaos and in subordination to the state, because to live such a life would ultimately damage the church, and thus, in the eyes of others, justify any persecution the church might suffer. So in conclusion, we see that although Peter appears on first glance to be telling us how to live our lives in these passages, it is with a clear and well thought out intention. And whilst the teachings of Paul that we are free from living under the law are important, the teachings of Peter give us that balance that this does not come with an excuse to not pay attention to how we live our lives. Firstly, if we don't live our lives in a good way and abstain from sin, how does that glorify God? How will others ever come to see the impact of following Jesus on our lives? Furthermore, if we don't submit to the authorities and instead we rebel, how does that glorify the church? And so how does it ultimately glorify God? It's in finding how we live our lives as free people in a way that honours others and ultimately God that's the challenge here. And that's how we should live our lives. And I do believe we're getting a lot of that right at the moment. And as I've said before, I do think that actually some attitudes towards the church are shifting. So if attitudes do shift, it's then considering how we subsequently conduct ourselves so that God is glorified and we're not seen as inciting disorder. And that's the key. As I said earlier, I don't think I know exactly what this looks like. And I think the message here is that whenever we consider our actions in life, Peter is encouraging us to think about reputation, not our reputation, but the church and ultimately God's. I think that has been got very wrong at times in the past, and my takeaway from Peter is our goal is to try to get that right. And that's it.